Amelia Earhart disappeared July 2nd, 1937. She was an American aviation pioneer and author. She was the first female aviator to fly solo across the Atlantic Ocean. During an attempt to make a circumnavigational flight of the globe in 1937 and a Lockheed Model 10 Electra, she disappeared over the Central Pacific Ocean near the Howland Island. Fascination with her life, career, disappearance continues to this day. Rich Martini is in contact with her. We'll talk with him about her and take your calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Rich Martini with us. We're going to talk to you and get your questions in a second. But Amelia Earhart, what is this incredible information she's passed on to you and you've checked out?
Well, here's the amazing part of it. It's all kind of amazing. But back in 2008, when I was working on the movie Salt, I had lunch with a medium named Patty Canova. She's a friend of a friend of mine. And in the middle of lunch, Patty said, "I'm going to read you. I'm going to do a reading of you." I said, "No, thanks. I appreciate it. I'm not interested." She said, "No, that's what I do." So she threw out some cards and said, "Oh, you've been working on a project about Amelia Earhart." And I looked at my friend like, "Oh, come on, you must have told her this." But no. So I, instead of being the doubtful Thomas, I said, "You know, let me just take this opportunity to interview somebody who might have information." My process has always been, I let eyewitnesses tell me their story, and then later I check on it to see if it's corroborated. Very simple. So Patty told me a whole story about Amelia's love life, how that she had an open marriage with George. We know about George, about the letter that she made George read during the wedding, but then she named her girlfriend. And I had heard through another source, not a medium, but an author, who had interviewed Putnam's wife, Dorothy Putnam, before she passed away, obviously.
Yeah.
And she said that she had walked in on George and Amelia, and another woman together in bed. And I asked this author, who's pretty famous, "Why didn't you tell anybody about this?" He said, "Nah, I just thought, you know, it was like the scorned wife." And I said to him, "If she was a scorned wife, she'd make up some dark story. That would be like, you know, George's dream." Anyway, and so ultimately, I found out the woman that Patty Canova was telling me was her lover was a painter. So, oddly enough, I become friends with Dr. Medhus, who's been on your show, channelingeric.com.
Mm-hmm.
You know it well. She had, and I had seen one of the interviews she had done, and I contacted Dr. Elisa, and I said, "You know, you guys should interview Amelia Earhart." She said, "We're interviewing her on Tuesday." I said, "Well, can I see the questions?" So she sent them to me, and they were like, you know, Wikipedia questions.
Yeah.
So I gave her the questions, and the questions included, "Who was the love of your life, and was it a painter?" So in the session, now it's Jamie Butler is doing the session, and she and Elisa's asking the questions, and she gets to that question, and she said, "Oh, Amelia just sat up," and she said, "You know, I don't want to rewrite history, because I'm very proud of my accomplishments as a feminist. However, yes, I had a lover, and she was a woman, and she was a painter." And then she talked about this woman. Now, for me, that was a confirmation, okay? Because, obviously, nobody, Jamie Butler and
nobody, nobody knew that publicly.
I didn't tell anybody, exactly. Yeah. So, but at the end, we got to the point of, she confirmed everything, that her plane was burned on Saipan, that she had been captured by the Japanese, all that stuff. And then we got to, how did she die? It was on Saipan, and somebody told me that they saw her shot, and another person said they saw her beheaded. Okay. You know, two conflicting reports. So that was the question. How did you die? And Amelia wouldn't answer the question. And here's what she said. If the third party who's asking these questions wants to speak to me privately, I'll talk to him.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Which is me. But I didn't notice the sentence until I was transcribing it for the book. Okay? Because I just decided, you know what? Include everything in this book.
Right.
Anytime you're talking to the afterlife, just include it. So I kid you not, a week later, Jennifer Schaefer calls me, this medium from Manhattan Beach, jennifershaefer.com, and says, "Richard, I love your books." And I went, ding. I said, "Listen, you do missing persons? How'd you like to be involved with the most famous missing person case ever?" She said, "I'd love to." So I took my camera over to her house, and I filmed her 3 hours doing an interview with Amelia. And I can verify that out of all the researchers I've met, maybe there's one or two that know as much as I do, but I know a lot about this woman's life. So every hallmark that we went through, she nailed, you know, that she had, her plane had come down in Millie, that she had been picked up by the Japanese, that she was taken.
Well, aside. And this was 37 before they attacked us at Pearl Harbor, so why'd they kill her?
Well, hold on. She didn't say they killed her. I'm just telling you. And Jamie Butler's thing, she wouldn't say how she died. So, and now I get to the question. So, how did you die?
All right.
Okay. And now, because that, now we're doing the private conversation. And she says, dysentery. And I say, oh, come on. I heard eyewitnesses tell me that you were shot or beheaded. She said, no, it was dysentery. I died in my prison cell. And then I said, okay, well, so what happened to you? And she said, well, I was dug up by two GIs. Now, that's part of Fred Gerner's research. 1963, he interviewed Hansen and Burke, these two guys who claimed that they were sent to dig her up.
They claimed they did.
Yes. So now this is Jennifer, who knows nothing about Amelia Earhart, is saying, two GIs dug me up. And I said, okay, what'd they do with you? She said, but they only got my arm. And I said, what? What are you talking about? She said, an Islander moved my body earlier. So all that they dug up was my arm. And my head is swimming, like, what? So I asked her about her plane. So then I said, well, where's your body now? And she said, on Saipan. I'm thinking, oh, please. So I say to her, show me. So Jennifer draws a map of where her body is. And I had just come back from Saipan, so I'd recognized immediately what she was drawing. Jennifer's never seen Saipan before. She drew an accurate map of this very small island and the details and exactly a place where I had been. I knew, looking at the
drawing.
So
you went there on purpose, right?
Well, I had gone there to interview people. I found 15 new eyewitnesses, but nobody told me where she was buried.
Oh, you didn't know that. Okay.
No. So now, so I'm saying, well, what's there? She said, the skull, my teeth. I said, how are we going to verify that it's you? She said, dental records? Okay, all right, fine. Now, I leave Jennifer's office with my head swimming, like, oh, my God, this is so bizarre.
Yeah.
Am I insane? The phone rings 10 minutes later. It's a friend of mine who is a former government agency guy. I don't want to say his name. But he says to me he's just been looking at these documents that talk about, he said, Rich, everything in your story is true. They found her briefcase, that she was arrested by the Japanese. He said, but when they dug up her body, they only found her arm.
Oh, just like they were told.
So I have subsequently found that story in the public record of these guys who were interviewed in 1977 who claimed they only dug up her arm and her rib cage, they say in the article. So here's the point. I'm not going to look for Amelia. I don't care that Amelia, as Amelia said to me very specifically, it doesn't matter. I'm still here. The important part of the story is she still exists. We're laboring under this weird thing of, like, her body is somewhere. Well, she's back home.
Doing her thing.
Doing her thing. Hanging out with her friends and her lover who was there. She introduced her to me. Let's put it that way.
79 years since she disappeared.
So, but over there, see, time is different. It doesn't feel like 79 years for them.
What a great
story.
For
them, it's like a stage play that maybe, or a movie.
But you got to go back and get the teeth.
I don't. And this is why. What's more important? The fact that Amelia proved to me that life goes on, that there is no death, or the fact that she's buried on Saipan? I think it's more important for the planet to hear that Amelia still exists.
Yeah, but give the info to Amelia Earhart Hunter.
Why? And you know, she said it very specifically, and you'll see in the book, she says it a couple of times, stop digging for me. The people who are looking
well,
for
I can understand
help them.
I can understand
not,
that.
And the point is, it's not about finding somebody's body. You see, that focuses on the stage. That's like finding a prop that someone dropped on stage and spending 79 years looking for the prop. Dude, the actors off stage with their hands on their hips looking at you going, what's the matter with you? Focus on the present. Focus on life.
That's a great story there, Rich. Let's take the call. Susan in Ohio, east of the Rockies. Susan, you're on with Rich Martini. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a kind of a weird question, I guess.
Nothing's weird on this show, Susan.
Right.
Nothing.
Coast to coast.
But I was wondering about, what if you have had someone in your dream, but you did not know they had passed yet? the night my brother passed away, I dreamt of him and my father, and it's like I seen the two of them, and my dad was leading him away, and I was watching them, and my brother turned to me, and it's like he was pushing me back, saying, "You stay here. Go back. Wow. You stay here."
Right.
I mean,
you got more work to do. He's going off stage. You have to stay on stage. But, you know, to answer your question, this is a weird part of the research, which I'd, you know, heard many, many times in the 35 people that I've filmed and that I've seen in so many other cases. People talk about that we only bring about a third of our energy, our soul's energy, here to every lifetime. So two-thirds of our energy, roughly, is always back home with our friends and loved ones. That's why when sometimes people have a near-death experience, they run into people who are still alive. And they go, "Well, I saw so-and-so, I saw my brother, and I saw these people, but they're not dead." You see? David Bennett was a Navy man who had a near-death experience, and he said he saw a friend of his back there, but he said he just saw the outline of his friend. And then years later, when he had another session where he was able to go back there and his friend had subsequently passed, he said when he saw his friend, he was all filled out, like he could really see him. So, but the idea that your dad and your brother were both there, I mean, they're showing you something to let you know they're okay. And the fact that you were able to experience that is just really a wonderful thing.
It's amazing how they communicate or try to communicate with us, Rich, isn't it?
Yeah, it you know, and I've heard reports of people where they say, I enveloped my loved one with a feeling of love, and, you know, at the funeral or at some other place, and, you know, the person is there crying, and then they're standing right behind them, and they give them this feeling of love. And then you've heard stories about animals and butterflies and hummingbirds. Well, what they describe is it's almost like they ask the creature to make an appearance to their loved one to let them know that they're there. Like in fact, I saw a video of a woman who whose son was in love with hummingbirds, and the hummingbird flew in the window, landed in her hand, then flew over to her son's photograph, like touched the photograph with its beak, flew back into her hand, looked at her for like a few seconds, and then flew away. You know, it's not like the person is reincarnated in a hummingbird. It's that the energy over there, which we can manipulate, you know, however we do it, we say to the hummingbird, "Would you do me a big favor?"
What about smells, too, like the perfume and the cologne? And
absolutely. And so what is a smell? It's an energy wave.
Yeah.
Right? And so what's a sound? It's an energy wave. What's a visual? It's an energy wave. What's a dream? It's an energy wave. People talk about injecting themselves within a dream, and they'll say, "Well, I chose the most comfortable dream. You know, my loved one was romping in a field of grass, and I was standing like 20 feet away to let them know I'm okay." Even then, sometimes they freak out. "Oh my God, it's my friend who's dead. Oh, I can't take it." You see, but that you're right. Smells, anything that has an energetic wave, we can manipulate over there. And we try to in the best way we can. It's just up to us to pay attention, to open ourselves up to the possibility that smell, that thought, that song that just hit the radio, that we suddenly associate with our loved one, that it's not a coincidence that that's happening simultaneously.
Jay in Florida, welcome to the program. Jay, go ahead, sir.
Yes, good morning, George. Good morning, Mr. Martini.
Morning.
I just want to point out I'm actually in Putnam County because I remember him saying Putnam earlier. George, I just want to say you've had superb guests and topics all week long.
Right? Oh, yes, and Mr. Martini tops them all, doesn't he?
I was told years ago that the signs are there. They're there. They've always been there. You just have to see them.
Yes, you have to open yourself up to the possibility that they are signs. It's very hard for people that are scientists who are trained in a materialist way, you know, that think that the brain is the only source of consciousness and when you die, it's gone. But if you start to look, you'll see Bruce Grayson talking about, Dr. Grayson from UVA talking about consciousness of the brain, Mario Beauregard talking about how he wrote about this guy who had an operation And he said to the doctor after the operation, "I loved your orange tennis shoes." And the doctor was like, "How could you possibly know that? You're blind." This guy had been blind from birth. But during the operation, he was able to see the colors of everybody in the operating theater. So that's a sign for us to pay attention that the reality we think is happening isn't exactly what it is. There's more to it.
Let's go back to you, Jay. Did you have a question?
I did, actually. I was hoping that wasn't going to be all of it. I wanted to get his take on people or a percentage of people who had negative experiences, and the percentage of them, or if he knows anything about those with the upper and lower dimensions, and if you can
talk about that.
Sure,
there,
absolutely. If you can move up or to higher dimensions. Other comments I have was Carolyn Mace talks about we have sacred contracts with people in life. And so if it's that our destiny and fate is pre-planned, say if it's we have a special or extenuating circumstance or situation, and if it's the soulmates, which aren't only lovers, partners, significant others, but any soulmates, so you reunite in different roles and in new future lifetimes and incarnations. And I wondered if any malevolent spirit could actually imitate a loved one. Because I've heard this.
Well, all right, let me answer those in the three parts that you just laid out. One is, well, let me just quibble a little bit with the word sacred contracts. You have people writing about this stuff, and they call it sacred stuff. Okay, when you look at your contract, your attorney thinks it's sacred, and the people you signed it with think it's sacred too. But we have the concept of free will is what rules the universe, according to all of these reports. So if you want to break your contract, you can. No one's going to spank you. No one's going to chastise you. They're going to feel bad for you because if you jump off stage in the middle of a play, you've ruined the play for everybody else. And so when you get back home, they'll say to you, "What were you thinking? You know, you suddenly checked out in the middle of the second act." And they'll say, "Oh, I just couldn't take it anymore. I was too distressful being in that person that I was." But total forgiveness when you get into the flip side. In all the reports, and you'll see this in Michael Newton's work, and it's in my work as well, there is almost no talk of evil or malevolence or dark entities or any of that stuff. When you talk about that, you're really talking about on a like the earth plane. And when people experience negativity during a near-death experience, my experience is when you ask them about it, and I've had it happen twice during sessions where the first reaction into the afterlife of a memory was, "Oh, I can smell sulfur and everything here is really scary and I'm frightened." And then the hypnotherapist says, "So why did you choose to come here?" And then it dissolves instantly. In Dr. Rajiv Partee's case, he was talking about seeing people with horns. And I said to him, "Well, what's negative about a horn? It's matted hair. Why would a horn be negative? It's only our conscious." What I found is that when people they live their lives fearing something, like the afterlife, you know, hell, something bad's going to happen, they may experience that for a brief amount of time where they find themselves, you know, being thrown around. And then they, at some point, they realize they've chosen to come there. And once they realize that that was their choice, to experience it. I know it's hard for people to put their mind around it, but ultimately, once you get beyond the light, everything is unconditional love.
You got that right. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Rich Martini with us with his book, Hacking the Afterlife, and your calls are all lining up here for you, Rich, so let's go right to them in the time we've got remaining. We will go to Susie in the state of Washington. Do you know Susie? Like I know Susie? Hi, Susie.
Hi. I wanted to say, first of all, this is so informative. I am glad that you had Rich on this evening, George, and I'm a longtime listener.
Right. Thank you on all fronts there.
Yeah, I just had to call tonight because I've got a story about a friend of mine that had passed away, and I didn't know he had passed away, and for a couple months I kept sensing this him around me, and every time I'd think about him, then out the corner of my eye, I would catch something go around the corner, and he had a dog, and his dog was a German Shepherd, big, huge dog, and at the time, I didn't connect the two, And anyway, so this went on for a couple months. I found out that my friend had passed away March 20th. Well, this was in May, and he had been gone for a couple of months, and so it just kind of hit. Oh, my God. No wonder, you know, that I had sensed him so much. And then, I kid you not, the weird thing that happened is I'd go outside for those 2 months, and this butterfly would bombard me. I mean, like a moth does. And I'd open up my door, and he would start hitting me, flying right into me. And I'd get scared, and I would go back in the house, and I'd go, what the heck? Oh, my gosh. I didn't put those two together yet either.
That's
and
great.
Then finally, one day, I went out there, and I sat down on the porch, and the butterfly, I thought, well, okay, if you're going to hit me, why don't you just land on me? So I put my arm out and landed on my arm. And that continued the whole summer, last summer. And I realized who it was, that it was my friend. And I would speak to him telepathically and tell him, okay, I'll be here at 7 tomorrow night. And he came the whole summer, every night at 7 o'clock. He'd land on me. He'd land on my sister as she was sitting there. He'd land on my cat that he adored. And long story short, this year, he came back. Of course, he's a little tattered. He doesn't look as pristine as he did last year, but he's back, and I'm just wow! It just blew me away.
Well, obviously, you guys are connected in some fashion, you know. And when you have somebody like a friend like that who just keeps showing up in whatever guise it is, there you start to think about the time when you first met him. You know, it doesn't have to be your lover or husband or wife, you know, that right. reminds you of when you had a soul group member in your life. If you think about when you met those people that had the most effect on you, you also find a feeling of, God, I feel like I've known this person forever. You know,
yeah.
It's a wonderful way of, you know, listen, the scientists will run around saying, oh, it's all coincidence. But ultimately, your experience is your experience.
Right.
When you sense that person being around you, I'm saying all you got to do is compare it to the thousands of other examples of it. And when you compare it to the thousands, you get this consistent report. And that's really all science asks for us, is consistent reports that are replicable. So that, for example, if I sat with you or, you know, with a hypnotherapist sat with you and we talked to your friend and we said, so have you ever shown up before? And then he said, yeah, I came as a butterfly.
Yeah.
You see, that's a confirmation of exactly what you just described.
Mm-hmm. And he's been telling me that I need to move on and forget him. You know, that to move on, get into another relationship, and everything will be okay. And, you know, I'm just scared to death to do that. But
well, okay, excellent. You just said it aloud right there. Scared to death.
Mm-hmm, I am.
We don't die, so you can't be scared to death. You're just scared.
Right.
So you're scared to do that, and he's actually, think of all the work it takes for him to show up and tell you. Go out there.
That.
You're here on stage to experience stuff. Experience life. Go do something you've never done before. Hang out with somebody you've never hung out with before. Think of all the work it takes for them to show up. So honor that connection that you have with him. He's telling you something that's so important, and you're not listening. Susan, get out there.
That's the way to do it. Next up, we go to Howard in New Mexico. Howard, welcome to the show.
Hi, Howard.
Yes, how are you?
Good.
Yes, I'm calling because, one, I got to tell you, I'm an atheist.
Excellent.
But, well, not excellent, necessarily. There's two things that always bother me in my life.
Yes.
I don't believe in the supernatural, but there's two things that always happen to me that always bother me. One is, when I was a young kid, about 9, 10 years old, I had a dream where I looked in the mirror, and I was an old black man.
Cool.
I don't know if it's cool, but
well, there's nothing wrong with that.
Reincarnation. But
well, listen. Let me describe that to you. We'll get to the second one in a second. So you know, if you had a hypnotherapist near you, and listen, this is not about believing in anything or belief. These are consistent cases and eyewitness reports. You're not believing anything. This is not about a philosophy or a belief. This is actually reports, okay? So if you could find a hypnotherapist near you in the NewtonInstitute.com, they have a searchable database for people who are well-versed in this. I recommend them because I've worked with them for so much and so long. You can ask, who is that guy? Who is that person that you saw in the mirror? You can ask yourself, but it's very hard to get a guided tour of who that person was. And what you find in these cases, and I've done it with many people, they remember a previous lifetime where they were. I remembered a lifetime where I was a Lakota Sioux. I write about it in Flipside. I remember a lifetime where I was in India. You know, different characters on a stage. So tell us, what was the other experience that's bugged you?
I'm an atheist.
No, but you said there were two experiences that bugged you.
No, I know, but this is the second one. I'm an atheist. I don't believe in God. I don't believe... Well, at least that's why I believe, but sometimes I doubt it.
Okay.
I had a dream a few years ago.
Yeah.
And in the dream, I was in my town of Las Cruces here, and we're driving down the road, and all of a sudden, the clouds started changing. There was like a hurricane in the sky. And then suddenly, angels and start appearing in the clouds and putting their hands together. But that's not the bad, that's not the weird thing. The weird thing is the emotion that I felt. I remember turning to my wife and saying, baby, how did I ever doubt God? And that's not even the weird part. The weird part is the euphoria I felt once I realized God was real in that dream.
That should hit everybody. It's all part of living.
Well, it's true. But listen, in these cases where I'm talking to somebody under deep hypnosis, and I do it in the book, It's a Wonderful Afterlife, I brought an atheist with me to a hypnotherapist, okay? And on the way there, I said, do you have any questions in case you get anywhere? And she said, what's the point? I'm not going to. I said, all right, well, just some questions. She said, all right, is the universe a machine? Then she said, what's this whole meaning of the shift? People were talking about shift in consciousness. And then the question, what or who is God? If there is a God, what or who is God? Okay. We get to this session, and she went somewhere really amazing. But ultimately, we got to those questions. She's talking to a spirit guide, and she says, is the universe a machine? He says, yes. It's a mechanism, however it's sentient. That's what he said. I'll leave it there. Second question, what's the thing about shift in consciousness? He said, imagine yourself being a crab walking on the ocean floor, and you realize you're in an ocean. That's a shift in consciousness. He said, it's not a big deal, but it's an important deal to realize that there's another reality around you. Okay, I get that. What or who is God? He said, God is beyond the capacity of the human brain to comprehend. So there's no point in trying to describe what God is. He said, however, you can experience God. And when he said that, I thought about, I was talking to a Bushman who had never been in a pool of water, and I was trying to tell him what it was like to be in a pool, and I realized this is ridiculous. The only way to experience a pool is to jump in it. You can't describe it. So when he said that, then he said, the way to experience God is to open your heart to everyone and to all things. And I realized in that moment the idea that God is love is actually flipped. It should be love. And the concept of what love is what God is. And just yesterday, I was speaking to Jennifer Schaefer, and I asked her this weird question. I said, is there anybody that we talked to in my book want to give me a quote for the cover? And she said, let me ask. And then she sent me these emails. And one of the people that appears in the book is Robin Williams, the great actor who I've met over the years. I knew him briefly.
And well missed.
And here's what he said. I have two words for you, Rich. Love, love. Love what love is, and then send it around to everybody because that's what God is. That was his quote. Now, I don't know if it's Robin, you know, it's Jennifer channeling somebody.
Channeling somebody,
like
sure.
But, you know, yes, God is what love is. And so when you feel that euphoria, unconditional love, you're tapping into what connects all of us. We are all that source. We are all that being. That's all part of us. We're all part of that same thing, which is love. No other word for it. We can't really define love, but that's the word that we can be closest to. When you have unconditional love for a child or somebody that you love, and you know what I mean by unconditional, no conditions.
Whatever they do, you love them.
Exactly. Very hard to do in today's world if you turn on television or you watch the internet. We don't have unconditional love for very many people. But if we try, just open your mind to it. Open your heart to it briefly. Try to just experience that. That's a universal love. That's our natural state of being. That's what home is like. Here on the stage, we experience all the rage and stuff we go through and fear, but the part that we're missing, that we all look for, is that unconditional love.
Let's go to Skype caller Dave in Mesa, Arizona. Hey, David, go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi, Dave.
I had a situation a few months ago where, listening to George's show, I decided to try something, and I was able to connect to someone on the other side who is a spirit guide. He's no longer my spirit guide, but he was when I was younger.
Uh-huh.
And I had asked him who my new spirit guide was, and he said, no one. I says, well, is there anyone I can talk to about connecting with a new spirit guide? He told me, you have no need to do so.
Said, well, that's what he means by no one. He doesn't mean that there is no one. He's saying you have the capacity to do so. And may I just add something? My wife was in a class where she connected with somebody. She brought a photograph of somebody, and suddenly they were talking to the teacher in the class. It was like a class in what you're talking about, connecting with the flip side. And the instructor said, why are you coming through so clearly? I mean, obviously, your guide came through clearly. And this person said, because the veil is thinning. And I've heard that consistently in my research. So whatever it is that has separated us from this knowledge or from your spirit guide, it's thinning. I don't know why. Could be the internet, could be electromagnetic waves, I don't know, who knows. But it's thinning so that you can access this information. But, you know, ultimately we all have guides that keep an eye on us. And they're funny. I had one guide was dressed in a monk outfit, and so we asked, why are you dressed in a monk outfit? And he said, because my clown outfit's in the cleaner. So, I mean,
they have a sense of humor.
They have a sense of humor. So when a guide says, you don't have any guide, there is no one. Well, you're talking to the guide, which is pretty funny, you know, when you think about it. Like, who am I talking to? No one. You know, I mean, you know, it's like the old thing. If you go into church and pray to God, that's normal. But if God responds, you're nuts.
Next up, JR is truck driving in Chicago. Welcome to the program, JR.
Hey, JR.
Thank you, gentlemen. My hometown. Give me the opportunity. I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller, and I just wanted to share a story. I'm an enlisted aviator in the Air Force, and this is kind of a weird story. Been to Iraq, been to Afghanistan a couple times, so it wasn't the first time. But I was going on a mission out there, and my daughter at the time, who was about 4 years old, made a big fuss when I was getting ready to leave. I remember her saying, I don't want you to go, I don't want you to go, and then telling me, I'll never see you again.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Wow.
And she had never done anything like that before, and I had gone plenty of times before. But
that must have been eerie.
Yeah, it was eerie, and my wife was a little bit upset, but that wasn't really a reason for me. I couldn't go to my superior and say, hey, I can't go on this mission because my kids, so I went along for the ride, and so we're in Afghanistan, and probably about an hour before we were getting ready to go out to the plane to depart, the sirens start going off, and we start taking some mortar fire, and the mechanics come out to our tent and they say, hey, we might not be going anywhere because the plane just got hit. So we go out to the plane and it's just complete Swiss cheese. It's all banged up and everything. So eventually we got another plane and we ended up getting back without any incidents or whatever.
But she felt something. There's no doubt.
And I was just wondering, do you think that kids are more, I guess, open to...
Absolutely. And I'll give you one example. You know the movie Foxcatcher about Dave Schultz dying. You know, John DuPont killed him. You know, the wrestler, wrestling movie. What they didn't mention in the movie is that Dave Schultz's father, in his eulogy, said, when my son was 5 years old, he came to me and he said, Dad, can I tell you a secret? And his father said, sure. He said, I spoke to my counsel, literally said counsel, before I came here, and they told me I could come and teach a lesson in love, but I won't be here very long. And Philip didn't remember that until his son was killed. So his son at five already knew what the path was going to be. And the reason I think it is, I've talked about this with some doctors, the skull doesn't harden until about the age of seven. So perhaps the reception is better. But my son, I talk about extensively in Flipside, and my kids and their stories, and I share some of those really unbelievable stories about remembering previous lifetimes. Here's the thing. We're not used to having our kids tell us stuff that is smarter than we know, but you just have to stay open to what the kids might have to say. One example is...
30 seconds left, Rich.
Okay. It was a police detective in New York. I was working on the movie Salt. He said his daughter kept saying there was a ghost. Turns out it was his partner who was keeping an eye on him, who had died some years ago. And I said, isn't it great your partner's still with you? He said, when you put it that way, it is. So kids see things we don't see, and we have to honor them for it.
Thanks again, Rich. Good luck with the new book, Hacking the Afterlife. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM with a couple hours of Open Lines. Get ready.